Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, November 1st, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we will be discussing the Affordable Care Act and appropriations. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today we are happy to have with us Professor Daniel Hemmel, Assistant Professor of Law at the University of Chicago Law School, Andrew C. McCarthy, Senior Fellow at the National Review Institute, and our moderator, Professor Aaron L. Nielsen, Associate Professor of Law at the J. Reuben Clark Law School at Brigham Young University. I will turn it over to Professor Nielsen to get us started. After opening remarks, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Aaron. The floor is yours.
All right. Thank you so much. So I'm excited to have Professor Hemmel and Andy McCarthy today to talk about the Affordable Care Act and appropriations. So first, let me introduce our experts, and then I'll give a few minutes of introduction, and then we'll turn the time over, the floor over to them. So we're going to start with Andy McCarthy, and he is a man who needs no introduction. Andrew McCarthy is a prolific commentator on the law who serves as a contributing editor of National Review and a senior fellow at the National Review Institute. Previously, he served as an assistant United States attorney for the Southern District of New York, where he led the terrorism prosecution against Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman and 11 others who were convicted of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. He also contributed to the prosecutions of terrorists who bombed U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. He's also a go-to expert on the internal workings of the Justice Department and talks about many, many, many areas of the law. Then we have Professor Daniel Hemmel, who is an assistant professor of law at the University of Chicago, where his research focuses on taxation, nonprofit organizations, administrative law, and federal courts. Prior to joining the Academy, Professor Hemmel was a law clerk to Justice Kagan. He also served as a law clerk to Judge Boudin on the First Circuit and Judge Srinivasan on the D.C. Circuit, and served as a visiting counsel of the Joint Committee on Taxation. So this is what our panel is going to be about today. Last month, and believe it or not, it is November, this has been a very fast year, the Trump administration announced that it will end the Affordable Care Act's government cost-sharing payments to insurers. These payments are worth billions of dollars per year. During the Obama administration, a federal district court determined in a lawsuit brought by the House of Representatives that these payments are unlawful because Congress has not appropriated the funds to pay for them. That decision was stayed pending appeal. Now, according to a recent White House statement, these payments must cease because there is, quote, no appropriation for cost-sharing reduction payments to insurance companies under Obamacare, end quote. As a policy matter, the results of the Trump administration's decision may be far-reaching. An important legal question, however, is whether the Trump administration is right, that these payments are unlawful. So in our teleforum, Andy will argue that the Trump administration is right about the law. Congress has not appropriated the funds, and the executive branch cannot send money that Congress has not appropriated. On that view, the Obama administration violated the law by making the payments, and it is wrong to blame the Trump administration for correcting course. Professor Hemmel, by contrast, will argue that the Trump administration has overstated its case and that, in fact, there are serious arguments in favor of continuing the cost-sharing payments. So before turning it over to the experts, I'm just going to tee up the background a little bit. I'm going to start by quoting Professor Nick Bagley of the University of Michigan, who has written extensively about the subject. So the Affordable Care Act provides two kinds of subsidies to help low- and middle-income people pay for insurance on the exchanges. Premium subsidies defray the cost of premiums for people making less than four times the poverty level. For those who make less than that, cost-sharing reductions help cover the cost of deductibles and other out-of-pocket spending. Although they serve similar goals, the two subsidies function in very different ways. The premium subsidies are refundable tax credits that go to individuals. They are administered through the tax code. For cost-sharing reductions, the ACA requires insurers to cut their lowest income customers a break on their out-of-pocket spending. In turn, the statute says the federal government will reimburse insurers for doing so. That's ending the quote from Professor Bagley. But there's a problem. Congress does not appear to have appropriated any money to pay for this cost-sharing reductions, or at least it's arguable that Congress hasn't. Nonetheless, the Obama administration determined that the United States would make those payments. The House of Representatives brought a lawsuit in the District of Columbia, in the DDC, and they prevailed. That decision, however, was stayed pending appeal. Since then, of course, President Trump was elected and has taken office. At that point, a large group of states became worried that the Trump administration would concede the House of Representatives litigation. So you had a massive group of interveners who came in at the appellate stage. Last month, the White House announced it would stop the cost-sharing payments because they're not authorized by law. That quickly prompted another round of litigation. On October 25th, a federal judge in California, in a case brought by numerous states, rejected emergency relief to require the Trump administration to make those payments. He concluded that the Trump administration appears to have the better view of the law and that a lot of the policy concerns may have been overstated. I'm going to quote, "And although you wouldn't know it from reading the state's papers in this lawsuit, the truth is that most state regulators have devised responses that will give millions of lower-income people better health care coverage options than they would otherwise have had." And that's where we are. So I'm going to turn it over to our experts to tell them to decide or assess whether the Trump administration is right in its legal conclusions. And we'll start with Andrew McCarthy. So take it away, Andy.
Well, thanks very much, Aaron. Thanks, Daniel and Laura and everyone who is participating today and put this together. As Aaron says, the Obamacare subsidy issue has two components. One is constitutional. The other involves statutory construction. To the extent there is disagreement, and there clearly is, it is over the statutory issue. I don't think there's any debate, certainly no credible debate that I can think of, about the constitutional principle. Simply stated, no monies can flow from the Treasury in the absence of an appropriation by Congress. There's no question, then, that the Obamacare subsidies at issue may not be paid out of the Treasury unless Congress has appropriated them. I don't think anyone takes the position that the executive branch has the authority to make the payments in the absence of the appropriation. Even the Obama administration, which began making these payments about 4 years ago, did not contend that the president has sua sponte authority in this regard. Instead, the administration's argument was that Congress had implicitly appropriated the funds. At least that was their essential position. Moreover, the current position of 17 states and other interveners that object to the Trump administration's stoppage of the payments is the same statutory argument, namely that the law as written provided a permanent appropriation to subsidize the out-of-pocket costs, just as it permanently subsidizes the premium cost that Aaron described. When I wrote my column on this issue a few weeks back, after President Trump stopped the payments to reimburse the insurance companies, my purpose was to defend the constitutional principle that the executive lacks unilateral authority to pay money out of the Treasury without an appropriation by the legislature. At this point, there doesn't seem to be any real dispute about that. So what I'd love to do is neatly frame the issue that way, declare victory, and end the discussion. But I suppose that we have to move on to the statutory question, which is a lot closer, admittedly, although it's now been resolved in the Trump administration's favor by two federal district court decisions. On that score, I do want to commend the thoughtful opinion rendered last week by Judge Vincent Chabria of the Northern District of California. He went through the questions raised with great care and with the recognition that although he was ruling against the states, their argument is far from frivolous. If that wasn't clear enough already, I'm sure Professor Hemel is going to make it very clear in a few moments. To my mind, this is something that should be straightforward, but has been turned into something of a crapshoot thanks to the Supreme Court's earlier Obamacare decision in King versus Burwell. I say it should be straightforward because, very simply, there is a fundamental difference between a statute that authorizes the government to make payments and a statute that appropriates those payments. In the Obamacare structure, there are two types of payments that are pertinent to our discussion, as Aaron described, the premiums and the out-of-pocket costs. There's no doubt that they're both authorized. The problem is there only appears to be a clear appropriation as to the premiums, not the cost sharing. Consequently, those pushing to compel the administration to continue paying the out-of-pocket costs are left to weave together an argument that what has not been clearly appropriated must have been appropriated by implication and common sense. They are helped along by the fact that King v. Burwell invites creativity in the construction of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. Like many of us Federalist Society types, I think that case was wrongly decided. Of course, it doesn't matter what I think, it's the law. And admittedly, the court has encouraged a great deal of creativity when it comes to saving Obamacare from its internal flaws and spotty draftsmanship. It's hard to predict with confidence what the court would do if this question ever gets in front of them. So that said, let me make three points. To the extent the states are arguing that we should imply an appropriation from the clarity of the authorization, meaning the directive that the fund shall be paid and the strong language to that regard, I think that's just wrong. It's black letter law that there's that a separate appropriation is necessary no matter how clear the authorization is. Second, to the extent it is argued that the out-of-pocket costs and the premiums are conceptually and structurally joined at the hip in the statute, I think there is logically a lot to be said for that, but the job of the courts, of course, is to apply what Congress has written, not read Congress's mind or impose the logic the court believes Congress intended to apply. And it's simply a fact that Congress treated the premiums and the out-of-pocket payments differently, that they are different, as Aaron described, they are different by nature, but they were treated differently in the language, in the structure of the statute, in where the different components of them and the payments related to them occur in the statute, how the payments are structured, et cetera. So I think, again, it's certainly not a frivolous position that they are related and therefore they ought to be treated the same. But I think the fact of the matter is they're simply treated differently, and the cost sharing requires a more clear statement of appropriation. Finally, I have sympathy for the argument from conduct. Not only did the Obama administration make these payments for years, the Trump administration continued them as if they were perfectly legal, notwithstanding candidate Trump's rhetoric about dismantling Obamacare. And it is very difficult to defend the administration's sudden discovery that the payments are constitutionally invalid after the administration made them for months and months. It's perfectly reasonable for proponents of the payments to observe that the president cut them off only after Congress failed in its latest attempt to rework Obamacare. From the perspective of appearances, it looks like President Trump is doing exactly what many of us spent 8 years criticizing President Obama for, namely acting unilaterally after Congress has refused to enact legislation. All that said, though, the difference here is that the president simply does not have the authority unless there is a clear appropriation. The executive may not change the law by failing to comply with the law. The problem with President Obama's unilateral actions is that they purported to create positive legal rights that Congress had not legislated. Here, to the contrary, President Trump is refusing to extend a positive legal right that Congress has not legislated. I wish he had refused to extend it from the beginning, but we are where we are, and I don't think that changes the fact that the president can't act without the authorization and in particular without the appropriation. So I think from that perspective, from a constitutional perspective, and from a good governance perspective, that the best way to repeal or rework a law that isn't working is to apply it and to fix it on that basis. I think the two courts that have ruled on this have found that the better of the argument is the Trump administration's argument that there is no clear appropriation, and until Congress clarifies it, the cost-sharing payment subsidy should not be made.
That's great. I appreciate that. Do you want to take it, Professor Hemmel?
Sure. Thanks very much for the introduction, Aaron, and for that fantastic summary and I think very strong argument against the payment of the cost-sharing subsidies, Andy. I want to make two preliminary points before I walk through the statutory interpretation that I think yields the conclusion that the Trump administration can continue these payments. First, we're not arguing about the future of Obamacare here. According to the Congressional Budget Office's best estimate, the Trump administration's action is going to lead to 1 million additional insured people by 2020. Not 1 million additional uninsured people, 1 million additional insured people by 2020. And an additional cost to the federal government of more than $20 billion per year. Now, that's $20,000 per additional insured person, which is a terrible deal. But that means that we have liberals here arguing that the Trump administration should act to save the federal government money, even though that will mean a slight uptick in the ranks of the uninsured. And conservatives arguing that the Trump administration should spend billions of dollars doing what's essentially pure redistribution, covering a marginally a greater number of people, which isn't to deny that the stakes are high. They're just different stakes than what most of the media coverage emphasizes. This isn't about the future of Obamacare. Obamacare will live, or it will die, but it's not going to be the stopping of the cost-sharing subsidies that kills it. This is about fiscal responsibility, and it's about two different views of statutory interpretation. So that's the first point. The second point is, while I agree with Andy that the executive branch cannot spend money without an appropriation from Congress, I don't think that follows directly from the Constitution in the following sense. We could live in a world consistent with our Constitution where when Congress says the Secretary of Health shall make payments, the Secretary would just go and make payments. There's no constitutional requirement of a specific appropriations provision. That requirement comes in because of statute. 31 U.S.C. 1301A, which dates back to 1906, says appropriations shall be applied only to the objects for which the appropriations were made, except as otherwise provided by law. And 1301D says a law may be construed to make an appropriation out of the Treasury only if the law specifically states that an appropriation is made. So Congress has, for more than a century, given us this rule of statutory construction. And for that reason, when Congress then passes another statute that says the health secretary shall pay, we know we can't read that literally because we have 31 U.S.C. 1301 hanging overhead. That difference won't make all that much of a wedge between my position and Andy's, but I think that it's 31 U.S.C. 1301 that supplies the governing principles rather than anything in Article 1 or Article 2. Okay, so we agree that the ACA, through two different means, tries to achieve this goal of ensuring that low-income individuals and families who aren't covered by Medicaid or who aren't covered by their employers can acquire comprehensive health care coverage through exchanges at a reasonable cost. The first means is this premium tax credit provision, 26 U.S.C. 36B, and it says if a household has income between 1 and 4 times the poverty line, the premium for the second lowest cost silver plan is going to be capped at between 2 and 10% of household income. Basically, they should be able to buy a silver plan without, if they're at the poverty line, paying more than 2% of their household income. If they're 4 times the poverty line, paying more than 10% of their household income. That's 36B. That was the provision that was at issue in King versus Burwell. Here, we're talking about Section 1402 of the Affordable Care Act. And 1402 says, if a low-income family enrolls in one of these silver plans, the insurer needs to make sure that copays and deductibles are limited to, if they're at the poverty line, 6% of out-of-pocket costs. If they're at 2.5 times the poverty line, it's 27% of out-of-pocket costs. The basic idea is we want you to get covered, and we want that coverage to be meaningful, and we don't want insurers to jack up premiums as a result of having to take on these copays and deductibles. So they are going to get payments from the Department of Health and Human Services. And Section 1402 says the Secretary shall make periodic and timely payments to the insurer equal to the value of these cost-sharing reductions. Shall make periodic and timely payments. The language is categorical. So the premium tax credits and the cost-sharing reduction subsidies are working toward the same goal of controlling costs for low-income individuals and families enrolled in silver plans. The premium tax credits and the CSR requirement cap the cost, the requirement that the insurer make these cost-sharing reductions, and then the CSR subsidies come in to make sure that the insurers don't respond to the requirement by raising premium costs, costs that would ultimately be borne by the Treasury in form of larger premium tax credits. Okay, so 1301A says appropriations shall be applied only to the objects for which the appropriations were made, and 1301D says you need a specific appropriation statute. And then 31 U.S.C. 1324 is a specific appropriation statute that covers Section 36B. Section 36B, recall, is the ACA's premium tax credit. So the secretary here has initially a problem. The health secretary has a problem. He doesn't have, from 1324, upon first reading, authority to make these cost-sharing reduction payments. 1324 refers to the premium tax credits, not the cost-sharing reduction payments. But he's also subject to this legal requirement under Section 1402, the secretary shall make periodic and timely payments to the issuer equal to the value of the cost-sharing reductions. So he's in a bind. He's either going to violate 1402 he's going to run into an appropriation statute problem. But maybe there's a way that he can read the appropriation statute as allowing him to satisfy the legal requirement under 1402 that he make these cost-sharing reduction payments. Remember, Section 31 U.S.C. 1301, this 1906 statute that governs us all, says appropriation shall be applied only to the objects for which the appropriations were made. The word object commonly means end toward which effort or action is directed, goal, purpose. And we all agree that 36B has the same end, goal, or purpose of reducing out-of-pocket healthcare costs for low-income individuals and families as the cost-sharing reduction payments. Okay, so potentially, the Health and Human Services Secretary can act consistently with this macro appropriation statute, this appropriation super statute, which says you can only use money for the objects for which appropriations were made by saying, hey, the premium tax credits and the cost-sharing reduction payments have the same object. I mean, they do have the same object. Is that the most natural reading of the text? I don't know, but it gives effect to both 31 U.S.C. 1301 and to the cost-sharing provision. Otherwise, if the Health and Human Services Secretary follows the Trump administration's reading, he is in violation of Section 1402, which clearly says the secretary shall make periodic and timely payments to the insurers. And a basic rule of statutory construction is that a statute should be construed so that effect is given to all its provisions and no part will be inoperative. Right? So if the secretary doesn't adopt this reading, then he is not given effect to the legal requirement in Section 1402 that he shall make periodic and timely payments. Moreover, the Comptroller General, which has interpreted this macro appropriation statute, 31 U.S.C. 1301, for years, says the standard for measuring the propriety of a particular expenditure not specified in the statute is the necessary expense test. And under this test, an expenditure is permissible if it is reasonably necessary in carrying out an authorized function or will contribute materially to the effective accomplishment of that function. And here, clearly, the cost-sharing reduction payments contribute materially to the effective accomplishment of the function of the premium tax credits, which is to control out-of-pocket costs for low-income individuals and families enrolled in these silver plans. And actually, doing it through cost-sharing reduction payments saves the federal government money in the long run. And it does that because if insurers jack up costs for the silver plans, as they'll do once they stop getting the cost-sharing reduction payments, then the tax credits rise. And families can then use the tax credits to buy coverage, to buy gold coverage or bronze coverage. They don't have to buy the silver coverage with the tax credits that are keyed to the silver plans. So if you're buying a bronze plan, you love the fact that the Trump administration is stopping the cost-sharing reduction payments for the silver plan issuers, because that means that your premium tax credit rises, but there's no reason why your premium for a bronze plan is going to be affected. Bronze plans aren't governed by this cost-sharing reduction regime. So here's what the Trump administration could have done. The Secretary of the Treasury and the Secretary of Health and Human Services could have issued a joint interpretation of 1301 and 1324, which apply to the Secretary of Treasury, and 1402, which applies to Health and Human Services, stating that in their view, the object of the premium tax credit provision is sufficiently related to the object of the cost-sharing reduction payment provision such that the monies appropriated for the former can be used for the latter. They would say this makes sense as a matter of policy. And I think most of us will agree that it makes sense as a matter of policy. It doesn't make sense for the federal government to spend more than $20 billion a year only insuring a million more people. They could say it conforms to the basic principle of statutory construction. Give effect to everything if you can. Don't let anything become inoperative. And under the D.C. Circuit's decision in Shirley versus Sebelius and lots of other precedent, there's Chevron deference to an agency's interpretation of an appropriation statute. Instead, the Trump administration disclaims this authority. The Hargan memo from October says really nothing more than Jeff Sessions says we don't have authority to make these payments, so we'll stop. I think this leaves the Trump administration legally vulnerable. I think a district court judge could say, Judge Chhabria didn't, but a district court judge could say, hey, there's a plausible interpretation of these statutory provisions that allows you to continue these payments. You have to come up with a better explanation as to why you're stopping them. Again, is this the most natural reading of Section 1301 and Section 1324? It's not a great fit, but it's, I think, the only way of squaring the circle of giving effect to the appropriation statutes and to the clear legal requirement in Section 1402 that the Secretary shall make these payments in a periodic and timely fashion. So thanks.
Andy, do you have any response?
Yeah, I think we have let me just make a few points. We have a basic disagreement, but before we get to that, I think Daniel stated the question slightly differently than I think I understood it to be, and then I think has been the overriding argument. I think Daniel said that the Trump administration can continue the payments. I know it's slightly different, but I understood the question to be whether they must continue the payments. And I just particularly given the way this tees up in terms of the principle that the president has to be guided by what Congress has clearly appropriated, I think the question really isn't whether he has discretion in this regard, although I can understand Daniel wanting to fit it under that, because if you're going to eventually get to, you know, the Chevron point, that certainly helps his cause. But I really think the question is whether the administration has to do this, not whether it has the discretion to do it or not. I don't disagree with Daniel that we could live in a system where a clear authorization implies an appropriation. But I just think that's not the system that we have, and it's not the system on which that Congress assumes when it legislates, which brings me to what I think is the crux of our disagreement. Daniel finds in 1402 in particular that the secretary is in a bind because the ordinary rules of statutory construction require that you give effect to every part of a statute, and I don't disagree with that principle, but I also don't think that principle comes in a vacuum. So that if you are in a system where it is understood that an authorization is not an appropriation, then that principle has to be factored in when you're doing statutory construction. So I think the basic disagreement that we have here is that I understand these authorization statutes to be more aspirational than mandatory, and Daniel is arguing that they're mandatory. Or mandatory if there's some creative way that you can construe the statute to make them that way. I think I'd be perfectly happy to live in a system where authorization implies appropriation, but I simply don't think that that's the one we have. So I don't think you're required when you're dealing with an authorization statute to give effect to every provision if it's understood that there hasn't been that you don't pay the money unless the appropriation is clear. Finally, I think otherwise what we're basically arguing about beyond that is this whole concept of whether the two provisions, the premiums and the cost sharing, are joined at the hip, which I addressed in my opening remarks. I think there's a lot to be said for the policy argument that Daniel makes, that they should be treated the same and that they're intended toward the same purpose and that they should be, at least in this particular, treated as one and the same. I just don't think that that's the way that Congress wrote the statute, and I think that the court is duty-bound to apply the language of the statute, not the logic that it thinks Congress may have been trying to impose.
Can I cut in and make two quick points?
Of course.
Great. First, I think that Andy acknowledges, and I think the other side has to acknowledge, that its reading does violence to the phrase "shall make periodic and timely payments." In order to arrive at the Trump administration's reading, we have to import some rule that "shall" doesn't really mean "shall." Now, my reading does, I wouldn't say violence, but a little bit of damage to the word "objects" in Section 1301. I am taking an expansive interpretation of the word "objects," such that the macro appropriation statute 1301, when it uses "objects," we can interpret the object of 36B to be the same as the object of the cost-sharing reduction payments. I think my reading of "objects" is linguistically permissible, whereas Andy's reading of "shall" is not. Shall means shall. Shall doesn't mean maybe, ought to. Second, there is an appropriation statute here. Right? There is 31 U.S.C. 1324, a specific appropriation for 36B. I'm not just saying that the existence of an authorization is all that HHS needs here. It needs an authorization plus an appropriation, the object of which is the same as the authorized expenditure. Second, I think here can collapses into must. My argument that the Trump administration can make these payments means that the Trump administration must make these payments until the Trump administration gives us some Chevron step two reason why it won't. And this goes back to work that actually Aaron and I have done on a set of D.C. Circuit decisions that address the issue of what happens when an agency says, we don't have the authority to do something, and a court says, actually, you do. You have discretion. You don't have to do it, but you could. And under this, what we call the Chevron Step 1.5 doctrine, the agency has to give some sort of explanation for why it is not exercising the discretion that it enjoys. Here, the Trump administration hasn't done that. Is it possible that the Trump administration could come up with some argument for why it wasn't going to make these cost-sharing reduction payments, even though it could? Yeah, it could say, hey, we actually want to cover more people, and there will be a million more people covered if we stop making the cost-sharing reduction payments, even though that will cost the federal government a lot. I would say that's bad. That's bad as a matter of fiscal responsibility, but it's not an impermissible interpretation of the statute. But the Trump administration, I think, cannot say that our hands are tied when I think as a matter of statutory interpretation, its hands really aren't tied.
All right. Well, I'm inclined to open up the lines for calls from the audience. But while we're doing that, let me just throw out a couple of questions. I guess a hard question to each of you. I'll start with Andy. And that is, so what's the theory here? Why is it? What's the logic that goes to the idea that Congress passed a statute that says shall, but somehow at the same time didn't appropriate any funds for it? Is this just a technicality? Is this an oversight on their part? Is this like smart lawyers to say, they weren't thinking? Or was this a policy decision by Congress when they enacted the Affordable Care Act?
First, let me open the floor to questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on, and after that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you'll hear a prompt, and you may ask your question. We answer questions in the order in which they are received. And to ask one, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. You can continue with your question.
All right, sorry about that. I'm a rookie at this.
No, I got it, though.
Okay, you got the question. So what's the theory here?
Well, I think that we're talking more about a matter of principle than, draftsmanship and smart lawyering and whatnot. What we have to remember, I think, is that we're not talking about we're talking in this case about one statute, but the principle we're talking about, namely that an authorization, even no matter how assertively and clearly articulated as shall, is not an appropriation. And if you're going to adopt a principle that the authorization equals the appropriation, you have to adopt it across the board throughout the government. And I think you have a real problem with that because there are an awful lot of things that the government authorizes, and there is a limited amount of resources for funding all of the things that are authorized. So the fact of the matter is decisions have to be made, priorities have to be set about what spending is going to be done on all of the things that the government has authorized. It's not just this particular case. And that's why I think you have a sensible doctrine that if money is going to be spent, it has to be appropriated because that's representative not of any particular statute so much as it is representative of Congress's determination under all of the circumstances that the government is dealing with, all of the threats, all of the social problems, all of the problems that are addressed by legislation. Here is our finite pile of resources to apply to all these different things. Which ones get paid and which ones don't?
Okay, that's all right. So here's my question for Daniel, and then I'll let the audience chime in. But so reading this I'm not an expert in healthcare, but reading the news, there was a lot of alarm about the Trump administration's decision, and then you see a large group of states rush to court saying that we want to, make him start making these payments. The tort principle of res ipsa loquitur seems to kick in. If it really is all that's going to happen is more people are going to get health care, maybe California and all those states are worried about the extra marginal expense, but that's not how it's being portrayed. It's being portrayed as a threat to the Affordable Care Act. So what's the disconnect? Why is it being portrayed this way if your version of what's going to happen is accurate?
I think there are three reasons. One, there will be disruptions in the short term that, according to CBO's best estimates, lead to about 1 million people losing health insurance in 2018. So if the CSR payments continued, 1 million more people would have health insurance in 2018. 1 million fewer people would have health insurance starting in 2020. So what Trump did reduces the ranks of the insured temporarily, but increases the ranks of the insured in the long term. So some of what the states are doing is just reacting to the interests of their constituents here and now. Second, what's going to happen as a result of the cutoff of CSR payments is that the sticker price is going to go up a lot. The sticker price for silver plans is going to go up a lot. And for those who care about the popularity of the ACA, that might be a bad thing. Because it's going to take some time before people realize, oh, we're ultimately not only held harmless by the premium tax credits, we're really better off because now we can use these larger premium tax credits to buy bronze plans and gold plans that are unaffected by the price increase. And third, it may be the case that some of the state officials who are reacting here don't fully understand the complex interplay of statutory provisions that animates the CBO estimate. Right. So the first time you hear that subsidies to insurers are going to stop and as a result more people are going to become insured, that's really surprising. Now, when one sort of untangles this statutory web, it makes sense. The premium tax credits run on autopilot. When silver plan premiums rise, the premium tax credits rise. When the CSR payments stop, silver plan premiums rise. So everyone's tax credit goes up regardless of whether they're enrolled in a silver plan. I think the folks on the call understand that, but that takes some explanation, and I think that there may be some bad faith on the part of state officials here, but there also may just be a good faith lack of comprehension of the statutory interplay.
Perfect. All right. Good answer. Do we have folks on the line?
We do. Let's go to our first audience question. Go ahead, caller. You may be on mute.
Hello, yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. There were a couple of things that I'm not sure I completely understand, but from what has been discussed, it appears to me that when we're speaking of the requirement to give effect of all parts, the statutory interpretation requirement to give effect to all elements, that I'm not sure that that applies to completely separate statutes, as would be the case in terms of interpreting object. And if we're to interpret object in that way, it would seem that any kind of border defense legislation would allow the sitting president to spend funds on the wall as he wishes. In addition, it seems to me that in the case of the... Well, I think that's enough there. I don't mean to add additional questions.
Shall I take that?
I didn't really get it, so I wish you would.
Okay, so
I didn't hear it well. I didn't mean to. I meant I didn't hear it well.
Great. I think the caller's question was, well, aren't you ceasing to give effect to the word object if you adopt the statutory interpretation that I'm proposing? I think the answer is no, because I'm not saying that you can just use any money for anything. You can use a specific appropriation for purposes that are intimately bound up in the stated object of that appropriation. Permanent appropriations that run on autopilot, like Section 36B, are pretty rare. So usually Congress gives a set amount of money for a particular purpose, and occasionally agencies or members of Congress will ask the Comptroller General whether they can use that money for a very, very closely related purpose. Okay, we have money to seize land through eminent domain. Can we use that appropriation also to assess value or to pay for litigation expenses? And the Comptroller General will generally say, yeah, that's close enough to the purpose. But even with this somewhat expansive interpretation of the word objects in 1301, 1301 still does a lot of work. 1301 still limits the ability of the executive to spend without congressional authorization. And It puts Congress on notice, as I think Congress already is on notice, that permanent appropriations are dangerous things and should be used sparingly, because when they are used, then they can be applied to otherwise authorized programs whose objects are sufficiently tied up in the stated object of the permanent appropriation.
We have another caller, so let's go to the next question. Go ahead, caller. You might be on mute as well. Caller with the number that begins with 8054, you can speak now. You might be on mute. All right, I guess we lost that person. To ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Our next telephone conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, Thursday, November 2nd, and that call will be on the role of Treasury in national security policy and will feature Ambassador Robert Kibbitt, Senior International Counsel at the law firm of WilmerHale. Aaron, do you have any more questions for our speakers?
I did have one more question for Andy, and that was Andy made the point that the Trump administration continued to make these payments, and he wishes that they had stopped paying them earlier. But this is just an honest question that I just don't know the answer to. But presumably there are procedures and processes in place for the Justice Department to change legal positions. And presumably you can't do that instantaneously. So, I mean, there's different theories about why they changed the decision when they did. But isn't there just a this is just how long it takes kind of issue? It has to go through the Department of Justice, it has to go up to the top to Jeff Sessions, and that's just how long it takes.
I think that it's fair to say that they have to have a reasonable period of time to get themselves up and running. But you know, there are certain issues that the incoming government catches that are complex and take them somewhat by surprise, because they're not completely developed, or they can't have the kind of complete information that you need to be inside the government to have. And the transition, which is fairly extensive period of time, is meant to address some of that. I think with respect to this, particularly given the position that was taken during the campaign, that we're talking about a straight up legal issue that shouldn't have taken a lot of time to master, and you either decide that you have the authority or you don't. You know, if the administration had taken 1 or 2 months because their appointees in the Justice Department hadn't been confirmed and they weren't completely up and running, I don't think that would have been unreasonable. But they let this go on for an awfully long time, and we know that there's been great debate every time this has come up, almost monthly, about whether they would continue it or not. So it's hard to believe that they didn't understand what the legal issue was. And I have to think that at a certain point, the administration was operating under the assumption that this was unconstitutional. And whatever you think of that conclusion, I think if you decided in good faith that it's unconstitutional, you have to stop.
That's certainly true. Yeah. Okay. And I guess my last point, this will be for Daniel, and then if no one else comes on the line, we'll end the call here. But this goes back to the Chevron issue and Chevron step 1.5. And you know, as you know, assuming that this is the sort of thing that gets Chevron, it's kind of a strange type of administrative action, just an appropriations analysis. But assuming that it is governed by Chevron, and even assuming, and I'm not sure that it is, that there is ambiguity here, there's a lot of cases in these Chevron step 1.5/Prill cases where they say, okay, we're going to let the administration do what it wants to do. We're not going to vacate, we're just going to remand, essentially, for further explanation. It seems to me that this would be a pretty good example of that. if you're going to have that built into the doctrine, why wouldn't this be the case where they say, okay, we're not going to let you, you don't have to make the payments, but we want an explanation later?
It's a great question. So would remand without vacature be the right approach if a court adopts my interpretation? Here would be the argument that the states would make against that. They would say, well, there's going to be short-term disruption, harm on our side, and really no harm of vacature on the federal government side, because the federal government spends less, not more, if it continues to make the cost-sharing reduction payments. So all the irreparable harm analysis, all the equities tilt in favor of the states that are challenging the cutoff of CSR payments and not in favor of HHS. HHS could come back and say, you know, cutting off the cost-sharing reduction payments really isn't that much of a problem. It doesn't lead to a crisis on the exchanges. It leads to more money in the pockets of people who are buying bronze and gold plans. And I think it's a tough call. I would tend to say it's a bad case for remand without vacature, i.e. a good case for vacature, just because the equities on HHS's side are so weak. But I think you're right. A judge could come out either way on that.
I should probably note that it's decided in the D.C. Circuit that remand without vacatur is permissible. There is a undercurrent, or at least some dissent on the court, whether that is actually appropriate. I know that Judge Randolph has made the point in the past that that's flatly contrary to the APA. That's just kind of a side point. I think his argument is with some force. But that's a question for another day. Do we have anyone else on the line?
We do not. I'll make a final call for questions. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad.
All right, we'll give people a few more seconds, but if not, I want to thank Daniel and Andy. This has been a very informative conversation. One thing I have learned is that it's hard to do statutory interpretation on the phone. It would be nice to have the text of the statute in front of us, but I thought working within that difficulty, both did an excellent job.
Thanks, Andy and Aaron.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.